With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Joining me today is Dickie Meaden on debut, and David Brabham.
Hello.
So it's 24 Grand Prix, 3 Le Mans wins, one of which is outright, 5 podiums, 4 Sebring wins, 1 Bathurst.
Shall one I come Spa back 24. In 10 minutes when you get to that?
1 Macau, 1 British F3 Championship, 1 All Japan GT Championship, and 2 LMS Championships. Which is the best?
Which is the best?
Yeah, let's start with an easy question.
Oh my God, what's the best one? That's a very good question, actually, because each one is a different phase in your life. Some were more challenging than others. Obviously, the highlight winning Le Mans overall is a kind of given, but it doesn't mean to say that was my most satisfying sort of win in terms of what we had to go through. It was that win in particular, I think, was satisfying more because of the politics that was involved in the team at the time and having to kind of navigate yourself through that and try and clear a path where our side of the car, our team, would make the right decisions at the right time. So that was as satisfying as actually going across the finish line first.
Is that disappointing when you're in a team like that and the politics become that, you know, they're almost as, you put as much effort into managing that as you do when you're in the car, or is it just part of the sport at that level, possibly particularly in a French team?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a big team, so you're always going to have some sort of politics going on. I'd say that was pretty high in terms of politics at the time. And I think that's some of the reason why I was brought in, to try and sort of calm that so down a bit.
Diffuse that
yeah,
situation.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah, because I guess I was the oldest one there, and I had a lot of experience working with a lot of teams, driving with lots of different manufacturers and small teams. So I got a really good mix of, you know, how to do things and how not to do things. And so when I arrived there, it was quick, you know, I had to learn the car because it was a lot quicker than what I was used to in America with the Acura. And then just getting to know everybody, understanding how the team works was, yeah, I mean, that was as big an effort as it was trying to learn the car and how to go fast. So it's kind of, you expected to be some politics there. It was probably higher than I thought it would be. But I thought it also opened up an opportunity because I felt if we could just do things in a certain way, we would have a clearer path than perhaps the other side, and that's how it panned out.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite to your Bentley run, where you had the car, you had the speed, you had everything but luck.
Yes, yeah, luck didn't quite go our way, that one. I mean, you know, we finished first and second. We achieved what Bentley wanted to achieve. Obviously, as an individual, you want to win. You don't want to be second. I can remember crossing the finish line with zero feeling whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just finished second at Le Mans. But I knew, you know, if you look at my career, I've not always driven for works teams. I've actually quite enjoyed driving for the smaller teams, going after the works teams, and then if you're able to beat them, that for me was much more satisfying. But you know, when I went to Bentley, again, it was a big team. It was quite well organized. And there were two halves to the team. There was, well, I'd say that the German side and there was the English side. And to be fair, the Germans did a very good job. Very methodical. The English side, I thought, could have done things a bit better. I was less experienced, I think, in knowing how to deal with those things, which I think helped me later on when I went to Peugeot, because I could see similar things that okay, I can see when that happens,
you need to
that's
do
the end result, and that's not the end result we want. So, you know, back then in 2003, I still had a bit to learn on that side. And, okay, I do believe you make your own luck. And I think some of the problems that came to us were self-inflicted in some ways. Difficult to quantify, but that's kind of, when you look at it, you kind of think, yeah, that we did trip over ourselves on a couple of things. We had the speed. I mean, the car was phenomenal. It was probably one of the better cars I've ever raced at Le Mans that could win overall. It was a better car than the Peugeot, but the Peugeot had phenomenal engine behind it. It was still efficient, but it was a bit more tricky to drive, where the Bentley was just really solid, and it just gave you so much confidence to just keep pushing.
So hence your numb, kind of emotionless feeling at the end, because you knew you had the car to win.
Well, yeah, and you know, because of, you know, like I said, I wasn't always in a works team. That meant that I only Toyota in the 92, when I was my first time there, was I thought I had a shot at winning, but we had a crash on the opening lap and we were miles behind, so we were wiped out completely on that one. But the next time I had a chance really was in 2003, because my years with Panos, there was no way we were going to win with that car. It was a great experience, a great challenge to go up against the works guys, and we even led, which is a miracle. You know what I mean? So I remember going down the Mulsanne straight with McNish behind me, and I'm doing this down the straight, I'm looking at the mirror, and I'm kind of giving him the bird behind as he's behind me, trying to keep him behind. But yeah, it lasted for a few laps, but that was our only real glory for Le Mans in that type of car. So you know, I knew going to Bentley, I had a real shot at winning, and those don't come around that often, you know. So when we finished second, I went across the line. I was just no emotion, so angry. We just sort of let that one slip, and because I got onto the podium, and you couldn't ask for two better teammates than Mark Blundell and Johnny Herbert to lift your spirits, you know. They quickly wrapped their arms around me and said, don't worry about it, Brabs, you know it's all over now, let's just enjoy it, you know, we can't change it. And they were right, and you know, we went back to the motor home, and all the drivers, all six drivers, sat down with the biggest English breakfast you've ever seen, because we'd kind of been starving ourselves all the way through eating seeds. And we ended up tucking in, and after that it was fine. But certainly when I crossed the line and going up to the podium, just felt like it took forever, because
it
didn't want to go up there in some way.
Lead up, and then the race itself, and then it's the limited amount of racing I've done. You get to an end of a big race, and there's a slightly strange what happens now feeling anyway, isn't there? So
there is, and the pressure for Bentley to win that year was immense. They had blown the budget big time. They obviously had to build a new car. They brought new drivers in for the third year, and it was a must do scenario. You have to win. There's just no doubt about it. So I mean, great result. They ended up finishing first and second. The cars were quick enough to be first and second. I think that's partly why that sort of felt a bit tough at the end, because you had a 50% chance of winning and you got the other 50 that didn't. So
there's lots of accusations almost. There was an Audi, but you drove both when you had that test, and was it Johnny Herbert crashed at the beginning and then you just jumped in an R8?
I jumped in the R8. Thank you, Johnny. That gave me an opportunity to drive an R8. So
was it an R8 with
very different cars? Very different. No, the car was designed by Peter Ellery, and it was very much an English designed vehicle. I can't say to you
the previous car was that done the same? I don't know. I can't remember, but certainly that one was. The only difference is obviously it had the RA engine in the back. And when you drove that, you know, out of the pits, you start going through the gears, you go, now I know why they've been quite successful. It was a phenomenal engine. It was just so easy to drive and just perfect for what you want to do at Le Mans. And then obviously Johnny crashed, wrote the thing off, and then I jumped in the R8 at the end of the test because there was a big tyre test. That's why we were there.
Yeah.
And that felt very, very different. But again, I got in and I thought, okay, now I know why they've been so tough to beat, because the car was just really easy to drive. The front end probably could have been a bit better. It was a little bit too much understeer, but very solid in the rear. Just gave you a lot of confidence. Yeah. And it just did, you know, just did everything you want as a driver, except for just that little bit of front end. But
did he get close to the Jag, the XJ14?
Yeah, the XJR14, I think, was kind of another level. Yeah.
It's what everyone says that's driven that car, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the just the best thing.
Yeah. Every driver I know who's driven it, whenever they're asked, you know, I always sort of read in the magazines or talk to them personally, and what's the best car you've ever driven? XJR14. I mean, literally immediately. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
That was a phenomenal car, and I mean, I never drove the Peugeot that came a year or two after when my brother won Le Mans in 93. That thing was another step ahead of that of the XJR14, so that would have been quite something to drive as well.
Do you compare Le Mans stories and cars and when you meet up and then
with
Jeff?
Oh, with Jeff, yeah. I mean,
is there like a no racing rule?
No, I mean, we do and we don't. I mean, you know, we don't talk racing all the time, just most of the time, but
cricket for the rest of it.
Yeah. I mean, it is ingrained in us, so you'd have to expect that. But you know, he didn't do as many Le Mans as I did, so I kind of beat him on that one.
I've actually got a few questions about Le Mans for my readers. Stephen Gate has asked about the Acura. How close was it in 2009 to racing at Le Mans, and would that have stopped you?
'09.
Would that have stopped you winning with Peugeot?
Good question, Stephen. Part of the reason I did Le Mans was because in my contract, we were not doing Le Mans that year. So it was kind of funny because obviously we were doing the Acura program. And you've got to remember that was around the financial crash. So all Honda's programs were being pulled. And ours got pulled, reinstated. We didn't know what was going to happen to it, and eventually it was decided that we would do that year, but we knew that there wasn't going to be a program after that. So we turned up at Sebring, and we started. Well, I arrived there, and I just looked at my emails just to see what was going on, and there's one from Peugeot. You know, what's your availability for Le Mans? You know, as a subject title. Yeah. And I've gone, open up, you know. And it was like, okay, wow. So I obviously had the ability to do Le Mans because in my contract, even though I was a full kind of Highcroft contracted driver, we weren't doing Le Mans. So obviously I had the opportunity to do it. But of course, Peugeot was a direct competitor in the P1 class. So I had to get the okay from Honda and Duncan, and Duncan Dayton straight away had said, oh, man, you've got a great opportunity, go and do it. But obviously with Honda, it's a much bigger process in terms of getting the okay. And it was, to be fair to them, it was only 3 or 4 days they came back and said, yeah, no, we've okayed it. So then we did the test, and I ended up going to Paris to sit in front of Serge and Bruno as well, and it was kind of funny because Bruno said, I'm not that in favor of you being part of our program.
Okay.
Because I was a competitor.
Yeah.
And I said the very fact I'm sitting in your office probably tells you about how I go about my racing. And I left it at that, and they looked at each other and went, okay, fair answer. And the deal happened very, very quickly. So was obviously, I got another chance to win Le Mans. You know.
The Acura was revolutionary, wasn't it? had the same tires in the front and back. What was that like to drive? Because you're obviously not used to that kind of thing, and then all of a sudden they're saying drive this sports car, which will feel completely different to anything else you've driven.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was the first time that those sort of big tires went on the front of a sports car like that. And if you look at what's happened since, that's the way the trend went. Obviously, it would have been better if Honda wrote the big checkout that was needed yeah. to make the tire a actual front tire and not a yeah. rear, because, you know, a rear tire construction and a front tire is very different. So it was
so the concept was sound, but the
concept was definitely sound, but it made it very difficult to generate the kind of heat on the tire, and that thing had a fair amount of downforce at the time, just didn't have the motor like yeah. a Peugeot or an Audi, but in terms of downforce it was quite high. But even still, we couldn't switch the front tire on, and so, you know, you obviously have a camber that you run at, and we would end up only running sort of that much of the tire
just to get some heat into that.
Well, just that's the only yeah. only way it would. Not that it would work. I mean, it didn't really work as well as we would have liked. And if you put any real steering lock, you just lost the front. So you ended up having to drive it like a 50p edge
yeah.
all the time like this, which was very unnatural and made it quite tricky. So I wouldn't say it was, you know, certainly it wasn't a plus in terms of performance, but it did make way for the trend later on for Michelin to build the tyres that you see today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one more question from Jamie Smith about 93 and the Jag. Did you feel robbed? They don't sort of hold back our
Do I feel robbed, James? Yes, I do. Simple as that, yeah. I still do. Well, you know, that's, you know, I still, even today, I still hear about things from people in the industry that obviously knew something I didn't know at the time, that have told me kind of, you know, in the last few years. And I go, what is that really? Is that really what happens? You know, so there was a lot of politics going on at the time.
Again.
Yeah. I mean, Tom, bless him, Tom Walkinshaw and the ACO hated each other.
Yeah.
And so we were wrapped up in all of that mess. And, of course, there was other politics going on with Jaguar. And Tom was a master at playing that kind of game. And, you know, on the weekend, we had a win. My brother won overall, so from a family point of view, we ended up having two firsts, and it was a great moment. And then obviously afterwards we knew that it was taken away from us.
Yeah.
So unfortunately we just got wrapped up in all that politics, which was a shame. But, you know, the race itself was a great challenge, and I had, you know, the car landed on my foot when I was doing a pit stop practice change. So I was putting DC in the car, and you know, the rear wheel came off, and I'm putting him in, so my foot's underneath the car, and then the air jack pops off, bang, right on my foot, and I couldn't move it. I mean, you know, it's just squashed,
pinned.
So they put it up, and then I run off, take my shoe off, put it under cold water, and so 2 days later I got the race, my foot's like ballooned, it's purple, and I'm having to wear a running shoe, not a normal race shoe. So
had you broken bones in it, or was it
no, I wouldn't say I broke it, but it was so badly bruised.
Yeah.
It was just painful to walk on. It was my right foot, and I wasn't left foot braking, because the gearbox just didn't really allow you to do that, and I wasn't really right left foot braking up until that point anyway. So I had to brake with my sort of foot on the side to use the rubber to do it like that, which wasn't brilliant, but I could still, you know, still manage it. Probably wasn't able to do the maximum, but it was enough, you know. Then I had a fuel leak in the car as well. So I'm driving along doing my stint. Probably got 4 or 5 laps to go on my stint. I go, look, I got a really strong smell of fuel. And they said, well, just if you can keep going, keep going. Okay. So then my feet started to slip. So
sloshing
around. Yeah, the fuel started to run towards where my heels were, where the pedal box was. So I could feel it slipping, and I'm getting on the radio and saying, look, my feet are slipping, I'm going to have to come in. They said, well, if you can get to the end of the stint, that would really help us. Okay, so I go to do the stint, come in, And they obviously pull it into the garage. They've obviously filled it up with fuel. They're looking to see the leak. They found the leak, and then they said, we found the leak, but could you go out and do a few more laps while we decide what we want to do with it? And I said, no. F off. Yeah. I said, you can damn well replace it. So yeah. they did. They replaced it and off we went again. And obviously back then it was the first of that kind of GT category.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a huge amount of competition. The major competition was Porsche with Stuckey, and Stuckey, or some, one of them hit the wall, and obviously that was a big problem for them. So it gave us a lot of room to have these kind of problems and still get to the finish. And of course we all didn't know whether the car was going to make it to the end anyway. And it did, and we ended up getting the win, but got thrown out later, which, you know, it's a shame for everybody who put the effort in leading up to the event, during the event, because it's not just my victory, it's everyone who worked on that program's victory, and it was taken away from all of us.
Yeah. Then you went back as a GT with Aston. That was quite – everyone likes that period, that GT1 period, yeah. The Astons against Corvettes, and it was just a good rivalry, wasn't it? What was it like on the inside, up against Magnussen as well?
it was great. I mean, I have to say, you know, that period is certainly, you know, one of my favorite times, you know, because Aston at that time were not a huge factory situation. You know, they didn't have the money. It was quite tight. It's very different now. They've got more money to sort of play with. But back then it was very, very tight. So to beat Corvette with their resources and drivers that they had was just the ultimate challenge, and we did beat them. And you know, at Le Mans, the DB9, obviously the first year we were there, the car was just way too hot. I mean, it was
hotter than the panels. Hotter than the panels.
Hotter than the panels. It was just incredibly hot. And of course it wasn't on the sort of the snag list at the top. It was at the bottom. Yeah. Anything to do with the driver
comfort.
Yeah, driver comfort was definitely down at the bottom. And it wasn't actually, well, I kept saying to them, guys, it's too hot. And no one other driver was there to sort of say anything. But, you know, if I'm in a team, if that's the problem, I'm going to say it. You know, so I said, look, this is going to be a problem. And of course, we ended up getting to Le Mans. It was the hottest Le Mans in a long, long time. And we just got cooked. Absolutely cooked, you know, 74 degrees in the cockpit, and it was just insane. And by the end, you know, none of us really could drive. I had a calf muscle just got ripped apart by dehydration. Darren Turner's foot had a massive blister on it because the pedals were so hot. He's got quite sensitive feet with that, so he found it really a trouble to go and actually drive the car at any sort of limit. And then Stefan Sarrazin had double vision. So when the between us, you know, I mean, you spend all this money,
yeah,
you know, and the driver comfort thing gets put to the bottom. And then when we were, because I don't know if you remember that time Darren Turner got a couple of penalties in his first stint. We were a lap behind before we even got going. So we managed to get that back to 50 seconds behind the leader with still a bit to go in the race. But of course by that time we were so cooked we couldn't drive, and we had a radiator leak, and they decided to change the radiator. That just gave us that little bit of rest.
Breather.
And Stefan's sort of vision came back. So it was decided that he would finish the race. And we still finished third, but you know, we could have had a better race if we didn't have the penalty and the conditions were inside the cockpit were better. Where Corvette have understood that for a long time. In fact, I think it was a race at when I was in the Ferrari 550 with ProDrive, and we were racing against Corvette, and we were at Elkhart Lake, and Johnny O'Connell was driving, and he just got toasted, and he just dropped like this. Magnussen got him on the last lap, and we won the race. And ever since then, they've just put a massive effort into driver cooling. So on that race, they were just cruising along, maximizing their abilities, where we were getting toasted, and you know, our performance dropped as a result of it, which you know, is not what you need.
Now, I messaged Darren Turner last night.
Did you?
In the hope of getting some dirt or some interesting gossip. But no, he had some interesting things to say, actually. A, that you were the best teammate pretty much he's ever had.
Oh, that's very nice of him.
And he learned an incredible amount about driving under pressure, and he picked out Le Mans 2007 last in the rain in the race with a Corvette. And he said that if you wanted a lesson in just soaking up pressure, that would be the one that he would pick out. So I'd be interested what you remember of that race, and maybe that that moment in particular, because it's quite unusual, I think, isn't it, for another driver to pick another driver's moment as something that stands out to them. So
I mean, you know, Darren was a great teammate, really was. We worked very well together. There was no aggro whatsoever. We just worked as a unit. He's a very, very gifted driver, so I was very lucky to actually drive with him and have the success that we had, because the both of us just bounced off each other. Going back to that Le Mans race, yeah, that was intense pressure, and I wasn't actually meant to drive. that was you know, I'd done my stint. I'm thinking, great, you know, the clouds looking pretty evil over there. I'm not due to drive, and the rain started to come. And it was supposed to be Rickard Rydell who was meant to. It was his turn to get in the car to finish it, and he just said, "Guys, I don't know the car as well as you do. I don't feel comfortable driving in those conditions." You know, which was massively brave of him to come forward and say that, because he worked for the team. So look, you need to put somebody in there that's got a bit more experience. So Darren kind of finished his stint, and I went back in to finish the race, and yeah, that was Aston Martin haven't won in years, you know, and you've got their victory in your hands that they're all waiting for, and it was horrendously wet. Even behind the safety car, the thing was aquaplaning, and then they threw the green when it was still aquaplaning, and the Corvette was much better than us in those conditions. It drove past me like it was standing still to try and get that lap back. So all of a sudden it got its lap back. So then we're on the same lap, and the only thing that felt like I had some control of the situation was my hands. It was really weird. I felt very disconnected to the whole car because, you know, the whole situation, but my hands felt like old hands on a steering wheel. So I just focused on my hands and trusted my hands through that process. And then of course we ended up winning the race.
So that must have been quite a different feeling to the crossing the line in the Bentley then.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I mean, that was a fantastic moment in certainly my career, and obviously the whole team that worked so hard on that DB9 program to win Le Mans in that way. And then of course we won again the following year. So we were able to carry that momentum and learnt a lot through that early stages. I mean, we were lucky to really win our first race with that car at Sebring.
Yeah.
Because leading up to it with the testing, I mean, the thing just wouldn't finish a test without an issue. And of course it was early days, so that's what you expect, because you go into the first race going,
but Sebring of all places, you wouldn't
exactly
expect.
I mean, you know, if you're going to beat the hell out of a car, it's going to be that place. So we gave it an absolute beasting in testing, and of course in the race it was just ran like clockwork, and we were competitive and the team did a great job, and I was lucky enough to finish across the line, you know, having Aston's first victory in the DB9. So a great moment.
Christmas, guys. Going to have to check that you finish your shopping.
I don't think I've started. I haven't started my shopping.
No, yet. I haven't either.
Okay. Well, Mercedes has an idea for you.
What's that?
Well, if you go to their website, you can get a 1-hour 4x4 experience around Mercedes-Benz World. So it's an ideal solution.
So you are offering that to us?
Dicky will sort that out for you. Yeah.
I'll put it on expenses. Yeah.
All you need to do is call 0370 400 4000 and quote off-road 1-hour driving experience, and you'll get to drive around, hack around in a 4x4 for an hour.
So it sounds like a good present, doesn't it?
And, well, speaking of which, could they still invest into Project Brabham for Christmas?
No, we've closed that whole campaign. It did its job. We've only done that recently, but we kept it open because we were successful in our initial raise. Indiegogo said, look, you've been successful, you can have what we call in demand.
I think it was Forever Funding back then, but it's called In Demand now. So they said, look, you can keep it open till you get to a certain point, you want to close it. So we did. And of course, initially people were still contributing, but over the last sort of 6 months, it's only been little bits here and there. And we're going through a kind of change at the moment. So we close that, coming up with a different way of communicating with the community and see what happens next year.
So I think last time you were here, apparently you had wine, fudge and brownies, but you're also saying you just come back from a visit to Ligier.
Oh, God, that was a while ago, wasn't it?
3 years ago, I believe.
Yeah.
What sort of change since a trip to Ligier? That's kind of a big step forward to...
Yeah, I mean, at that time, we were obviously trying to understand the LMP2 market and understand, you know, what would it take to get one of those cars, understand more about the car, what were the pros and cons, things like that. And, of course, one of the challenges with Project Brabham has been, you know, we got an initial fundraise, but there's no mechanism for any other money to come in. So your burn rate... you know, is quite high, obviously, because there's nothing else coming in. So to manage all of that all the way through this process is, like I said, has been quite a challenge. So the way we kind of went out to investors has changed. So much has changed because of that first probably year and a half. It was very difficult to sell something to an investor which was just an idea and a name. You know, so we took that feedback and thought, well, okay, we've got to think about this a little bit differently. We took a different direction, and that direction looks like it might pay off. So we're still working towards it, but it's a lot better shape than it was, say, 12 months ago.
Yeah. So if you had signed that deal with Ligier, would you have been worse off because of the rule changes and the problems that's been in LMP2 in the past few years?
Yeah, I mean, it was depending on how much money you had, obviously, if you could absorb that change. If you look at the time, Ligier were the hot car to have. I can't find a Ligier out there at the moment. You know, they're all Oricas. So, you know, yes, potentially that could have been a problem. But we were nowhere near in a position to be able to do that. I mean, we raised $300,000. That is not going to get you a race team. Yeah. That, you know, it's not even going to buy you a car.
Yeah.
So we had to obviously go out and try and raise more money and get the right partners. And that's just they don't come on trees. You know what I mean? So the amount of doors I've knocked on in the city trying to raise money, and because I've never done that, I don't know how that world operates. And so you're going in blind, and then you think, oh, there's an opportunity, and then you go off on this direction because you don't have the experience to know whether or not it's real, and unfortunately you have to learn the hard way, you know. So that's when we probably had to kind of put a stop to the way we were going to market and find another solution. And like I said, that other solution has had a lot more traction than going the way we did it. So it's just, these things take time. I mean, when I started, I really thought, you know, within a couple of years we'll be racing, we'll be doing all this, but you know, I was so inexperienced in that area. It was all hope and you know, yeah, we should be able to achieve it. But
you're kind of doing it the other way to most people. Like, most people make a lot of noise and then they don't actually deliver on anything and it just fades away. I think you guys have made some noise to start with, but then
like I said, it hasn't been easy. It's been quite a challenge. So what we're working on, I think if we can pull it off, then I think people will go, fair dues.
Yeah. And would IMSA offer opportunities for you, or would the P1 now be more, even if this isn't Project Brabham, but as a team owner, would you look at IMSA over P1 now?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, if you put your sort of cards on the table and you're kind of looking at it, you know, IMSA obviously has some attraction. I think the manufacturers are quite keen to get more and more involved. Obviously, Honda are now coming back with Penske in that program. It gives them the opportunity to develop and sort of contribute than just buying a standard car and going racing. The LMP1 situation...
you know, you could buy a stock kind of standard LMP1 and potentially win Le Mans next year, yeah. You know, if you get it right. Don't know what Toyota are doing. I mean, they sound like they're coming back, which would be great, but, you know, they're going to be streaks ahead of everybody else, as Audi were for many, many years. So, you know, there's nothing new about that. Be great to see Alonso racing there. Exactly. And I think it will be great, not just for sports cars, but for the sport in general. Yeah.
There's a real competition as well in LMP1 if you're behind Toyota.
Yeah.
Which must be a...
For next year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which must be a positive as well for the sport and for sports cars. You must have a vested interest as well, have such a career in sports cars. But are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
Always optimistic to a point. But as you said, if you kind of went through that list at the very beginning, I've been around a while and I've seen a lot of cycles within sports car racing where it's manufacturers piling money into it, the technology goes like this, the spending goes like this, and then they go, oh, hang on a minute, we're spending too much money, and they go out. And it goes back down, falls into the privateers' hands to keep the sport going, and that opens up opportunities. There's no doubt about it. But it's just the nature of the game. You know, we're going through another cycle. I think the amount of time that the World Sports Cars has been around is enough where there's a fairly good footprint and foundation to keep it going. So it's not vulnerable like perhaps it's been in the past. It's pretty solid in that sense. So that's good for the future. And it will open up opportunities for potentially other teams to win Le Mans against the manufacturers, because if the Toyotas stop like they did last year, which is, you know, still possible, I'm sure it would be not good for them if they only had to beat themselves like that. Yeah, it would be even worse, which I'm sure they're contemplating the risk factor in all of that.
It is a tricky one, isn't it? Because if they win, it's, well, they should win because they're the only big team there. If they lose, then...
It's lose-lose, in a way.
But it would be a shame if they weren't... If they weren't there, I think they probably understand more than anyone that you can't just turn up and expect to win that race, because it's been almost close enough to touch Toyota.
I mean, you know, they got so close 2 years ago, didn't they? I mean, it was heartbreaking to see that. And I've always said afterwards, could you imagine if Porsche pulled up behind and pushed that car across the line? The goodwill towards Porsche, you couldn't buy that.
Yeah,
you know. But they didn't.
As a team manager, would you be on the radio saying, just
get behind there, nudge him along, and just push him to it. Yeah, it's like cars, you know.
And one quick hypothetical question from Ben Dreco. If Brabham hypothetically returned to Formula One, who would you have as drivers? I guess that's an open question. Unlimited budget, presumably. On the grid right now, who do you... Or not on the grid?
That's a good question.
That is a really good question. Well, first of all, Brabham back in F1 would be obviously a great thing, as long as it's got the right sort of business sense behind it. It's not just an emotional thing. It makes sense. There's something that will be in place to make it sustainable, to keep the thing going, because you can be in and out of that environment pretty quickly if you don't have the right partners and stuff. But if I was involved and I had the choice of drivers, obviously it would depend on how competitive the car is.
He's buying time to think here, isn't he?
Well, no, I'm just thinking of the scenario, because you say you've got any driver, but if you're a midfield driver, you don't have the choice.
Yeah.
So if you're winning, then obviously you would have choice. So am I a team that's winning, or am I a team, a midway team?
You come in as Sauber. Who'd you get then?
What kind of budget have I got?
enough to attract the right driver for Sauber, to do the job for Sauber. Or do you get someone that brings in budget?
What do you get a pay driver to then pay another driver? Or it's such a complicated question, actually, isn't it?
I mean,
let's not blame Ben, but
you know, if you're thinking of drivers outside of F1 at the moment, like Sauber's your kind of next step in. You know, if you know, I think Leclerc is a definite talent. Ollie Roland is another one, you know. So I would be looking to bring someone in who's young and be able to develop them in Formula One, but also have another driver that's quite experienced and can bring a lot to the game. You know, I quite like Daniel Ricciardo. I think he's a
big step down, though.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, so, you know, would he be interested in driving for Sauber? Yeah. No, he wouldn't be, you know. But, you want that type of driver that can take that team forward. You know, you need that sort of pyramid shape with that one driver driving it forward and the other drivers learning as he goes along. You know, that dynamic is, in that environment, works well. And when I went to Peugeot, normally I was the number one driver in the teams that I drove. So I was the one who's at the front saying, right, this is how we're going to do it. But when I got there, that was Alex Wirtz. So for me, I had to go, well, okay, there's no point me trying my ego to try and be the best and sort of nudge him out of the way. That was never going to work. So I had to respect the fact that he was the leader in that sense. So my job was to back him up. And that's how we made that thing work, you know.
You get Nico Rosberg. I think he was looking quite, you know, he was looking at the cars, wasn't he? He looked like, oh,
was he?
I wish I was there.
I'm not sure he was looking that far back, though.
Well, maybe not. But
and, you know, I've done Formula One twice now with teams that just didn't have enough money.
Your career trajectory, you'd work hard to get to Formula One. You get there, your family name's over the door, but you must have known, in your heart, you know the situation the team is in relative to...
Well, I didn't
to,
know when I...
I
had no idea, because Formula One was just not on my radar. I thought, when I came to England, I thought, okay, I'm doing Vauxhall Lotus, so I'll probably do 2 years of Vauxhall Lotus, 2 years of F3, 2 years of F3000 at the time, and I might get a Formula One chance. You know, I did half a year of Formula Vauxhall Lotus, half a year of Formula 3 Class B, 1 year of Formula 3 Class A, and straight into Formula One. And, you know, at the time, I was going to be doing Formula 3000 with Middlebridge, and Damon Hill as my teammate. And, you know, we were about to go testing with the new cars. We were testing the next day. Everything was done. And then they came in and told us, we're closing the team down. What do you mean you're closing your team down? Because they had bought Brabham. And we were going to do F3000. And it was like, what? You know, so they pulled me in and they said, we want you to do Formula One.
So that's got to be a mix of emotions, hasn't it? If you know you're on a...
Well, they did ask me to do Phoenix that week of the Phoenix race. So we want you to come and do Phoenix. And I said, no thanks. And they went, what? And I said, I've never driven the car. I'm not fit enough. I just knew I wasn't going to do the job justice. So I said, no. And then obviously two races in, they closed the 3000 team down. It was either do nothing,
try and find
a driver, which was too late by then, or do Formula One. And the BT58, which was from the 1989 season, was a good car. It actually had a podium, and that was the car I first tested, and I thought, oh, this thing is, and it was such a beautiful car to drive. Did everything you wanted it to do. And then the BT59 came through, which, you know, the gearbox wasn't ready, so we had to fit the old gearbox in, and it had the wrong geometry on the rear. It had the aerodynamics were all wrong.
So there's compromise built in all the way through from the start.
And it was unreliable. It was the first time they went to transverse gearbox. So we always had gearbox problems, which meant, you know, my first Grand Prix, I think I did five laps before qualifying, my first Grand Prix, you know, and I missed out qualifying by 0.3. So I was... For me, I was quite personally happy that I was able to get that close, because back then it was 30 cars
going
for qualifying. It was 26 only going through. So it was cutthroat down the back.
if you had any issues, you know, like that, you were struggling. And I didn't qualify for 6-7 races or something because of those problems.
Yeah.
And what I didn't realize at the time when I got there, that they ran out of money. So I'd be going into the workshop thinking that the trucks have left, you know, to go and see some of the guys, and the
monocoque had left, is, but
trucks were still there. The monocoque sitting there with no engine, and it's like, well, what's happening? He said, well, we haven't. No one's paid for the engines yet. Judd won't release until someone's paid for the engines. So we just every race it was like this from halfway on. So
how did you feel at that point? Did it just feel like your career was out of control because all the things that you couldn't control were just swirling around?
Yeah, I it was the first time I'd ever been in a situation where I just had no control of what's going on. And half the team wanted me, half the team didn't. And the team that didn't, the justification was you weren't experienced enough. And I totally get that.
Yeah.
But if that's what you've got, then surely work towards helping to make the best of that situation. And they didn't do that at the time. So they were good lessons for me in terms of what helped me in working with teams and making sure you work in a particular way where everybody's working for one another. Because I really hit it big time when I went to Formula One and saw that, never having had that experience, I didn't know how to deal with it. So it was a tough year from that point of view. Yeah.
How do you look back on it now, like with regret, with I guess probably not a lot of fondness looking back, is it?
I guess the 2 years in Formula One, certainly okay, lucky to have done it, you know.
Better to have been there than never been there at all.
Yeah, you know, because it helped. What it did help me was with my CV later on. I had F1 experience, okay? Wasn't like my father's success, you know, but it was...
Not many people have that, to be fair.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But that was, you know, obviously that's my benchmark. That's what people were looking at me going, well, your dad's achieved that. What are you achieving? You know what I mean? And I was down the back not qualifying. So I wasn't doing a particularly good job in a lot of people's eyes, you know, but they didn't realize the difficulties that we had at the time either. So when I look at Formula One, it helped me have a good sports car career because of the experiences and the perception that I was a Formula One driver. Obviously, I never got the equipment to do what I think in terms of my talent justice.
And that's borne out in your achievements later in your career, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was obviously, after I left Formula One, my career took off in many ways, you know. So, but the experience I gained from that helped me in that sports car path. Yeah.
What one thing that struck me when I was doing my homework, looking through your CV, the difference now, I guess sticking with Formula One in a way, but the difference now and... You know, when you started, I think I'm right, so when you started karting, you were probably the same age that Max Verstappen was, roughly.
When you did F1.
When he went to F1.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a mind-blowing thing, isn't it? But do you think that's good for the sport? Do you think it skews people's careers? Again, clearly, if you can get to Formula One, you want to get to Formula One, whether you're 30, 20, whatever age, but that's a massive change, isn't it, in terms of your learning your craft and your ability to function as a professional throughout a career.
Yeah, I think as a young driver, you're in some way, you're obviously fighting against all your other competitors, but you're fighting also the culture of thinking within Formula One. So when I went there, okay, I started karting when I was 17. I'm 24 and I'm a Formula One driver. And I was the second youngest on the grid.
Yeah.
So JJ Leto was younger than I am. And we were the two youngest. Everyone else was sort of 26, 27 and above, you know. So everyone who had a team went for the more experienced, older driver. And of course, now they're all looking for this young gun that comes through that's kind of fearless, and there's not many Max Verstappens around.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you get to a point in your career in F3 or F2 and you're 25, 26, you know, pretty much people have written you off of not getting into Formula One because they see you as being too old, even though you've got a lot of experience. So you're fighting against that
that mindset, as well as obviously it's so money driven now. At least when I did it, there were still some opportunities to get into Formula One without having to bring money. Now, I've never bought a penny to a race team. I was just never in that situation. Yeah. So, and it's something I'm proud of, because I was a paid professional from F3 onwards. So not many of us can say that. So for me, it was I was lucky in many ways, because in F3, I got a free drive because there was sponsorship. You know, there was a lot more sponsors in F3. There were opportunities for free drives or subsidized drives. And I got a free drive. I won a competition against four other drivers for the Juicen drive. So I got that, won the championship, bang, straight into Formula One being paid. And I've been paid ever since.
Do you think it's easier now or harder? So if you were Sam's shoes, would you think it's easier to make a living out of motorsport now than it was when you started? Just a living, not to get to Formula One or...
Possibly make a living but not follow the path in the sport that you want to follow, maybe, I don't know.
There are probably opportunities to make a living now that, you know, GT is so big, which it wasn't back then. You know, WEC racing, there's some manufacturer involvement still. You know, particularly with GT, there's a lot of GT drivers racing for manufacturers who get paid and they make a living, you know, like I did when I raced for Aston Martin. But in terms of that path, the Formula One is much more difficult, much more difficult. I mean, you can get to F2 and never see Formula One.
You could probably win F2 and probably never see
F1. Exactly. Yeah, you know, and we talked about Ollie Rowland, you know, who's, you know, is a very talented driver, but what does he do next year if he doesn't have an F1 gig?
Yeah.
Yeah, sport's got very short and increasingly short memory, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah, because within a year, everyone will forget about Ollie Rowland, you know, so it's really important he finds something to keep himself out there. But, you know, he's been on that Racing Steps Foundation, which is one of those rare programs in today's world where someone talented can get a free ride for a while, you know, and they've supported a lot of drivers and still do. You know, without them involved and Red Bull and stuff, it would be very difficult.
Did you try and deter Sam or into getting into motorsport? Or was it just his decision? And
I didn't push him. And when he started to sort of nag me about getting into a go-kart, it was a while before I put him in one. I was busy doing stuff and it was like, okay, how serious is this? And he kept nagging, nagging. And I remember being on an aeroplane going to America, one of my many trips to America, and I'm hearing his voice in my head, and I go, okay, you idiot. Put him in a go-kart. So when we got back, I put him in a Rive and Drive at Bucknell Park, and he loved it. And you know, he hasn't had the career I've had at that early age. I've been so busy working on my own project, which will help him in the future, but I've had to sacrifice my ability to help him, which, you know, has been difficult for him.
How did that process work with you and your dad?
Well, when I started, I was 17, left school, and I was working on the farm.
So was that an important thing that you... Was it a necessity or choice that you didn't get involved in karting or competitive driving sooner? Or,
well, Dad didn't want us to drive.
Okay,
so that was very clear. I went to an agricultural boarding school to learn about agriculture because I was being groomed to be a farmer. And at that time, I knew nothing about motor racing. Seen a few races, but you know, and I was interested because, you know, Dad had old magazines and he'd come back with an Autosport or something, or a
motorsport
magazine. Yeah, I was going to say a motorsport magazine, and you know, I was interested. And I, funny enough, I can remember reading a lot about Mike Thackwell, who's my brother-in-law. You know, it's like, you know, I'm on the farm reading about this guy called Mike Thackwell, and it's funny, but I had no desire or interest or knowledge about motorsport at all till I went to America when I left school and I saw Jeff race Indy cars. And that was like, wow, okay, this is different to chasing sheep. So I ended up going around with him and I saw a go-kart in a workshop, and I've spoken about this many times, but I didn't even know people race go-karts.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a bit of an eye-opener, and it was the seed. Seeing that go-kart, being with IndyCars with Jeff for sort of 3 months,
I was in America. And I was really interested, actually, at that time, more on the technical side, even though I'm not a mechanic or an engineer, but I was really interested on how a car worked. So I'd always be in the engineering meetings, listening and learning, you know. So that really got the momentum going. So when I went back to Australia, I said to Dad, I want to get in a go-kart. And he just was stone-faced. Yeah. He just didn't want to get involved. So I convinced my neighbor to go to a go-kart meeting in a place called Griffith. I said, look, there's a go-kart meeting. Oh, let's go and have a look. Oh, yeah, okay. Because we had a go-kart, but it was like a, you know, Briggs & Stratton engine, you know, and it was just a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And we went to the go-kart meeting and, like, you know, just we just couldn't believe what we were watching. It was a New South Wales country titles. It was a big meet. And we decided right there and then that we would buy a secondhand go-kart, which we did because he was working on the farm and I was working on the farm, so yeah. I was getting a bit of money. We put our money together and we bought a secondhand go-kart, and that's how it started.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Paul Fernley, you probably know, journalist, he has asked what the best piece of advice your dad ever gave you. I assume it wasn't on the grid at Adelaide, but...
no, it was actually. That wasn't advice. He got me... The one thing Dad never really gave much advice. He was very much of the opinion, there's the steering wheel, get on with it.
Do your own thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know. And he would come to a few races and he was so good at seeing what you were doing wrong.
Annoyingly, I know.
I mean, you just don't want to hear it from your dad, do you? But he was right, and that always made me feel uncomfortable. But I knew he was right at the same time. But I had to learn myself, and when it got to that Adelaide race that you're talking about, you know, when I had the argument with him before, what that whole race showed me was the very thing that he'd always used to say to me. He'd always just go, David, it's all in here. And that's all he'd say. And it took a while to understand what that meant. And he was damn well right. And he knew from being a competitor himself,
yeah,
when you drove really well to when you drove well and what made you drive really well. And it's a mindset. What gets you into that mindset, what motivates you, what makes you angry, how can you turn that into extra motivation? You know, all these little things make the difference. And that was my first experience at Adelaide in 87, going from last to first.
Yeah.
In a rage. I was in an absolute rage because my dad and I had a massive falling out and I was going to show him. But that intent that I had was so much more than I had in any other race up until that point.
That's a sort of energy that
it's an energy, exactly. And you build it up by a process of your thinking. And then, of course, something like that triggers something inside you where you got to be careful because that could have been a disaster. I could have been so angry. Yeah, I just lock up. I've taken off six cars because I've got 30-odd cars in front of me. But I realized then I was able to control it. And when I got to the end of the race, I went, how the hell did that happen?
It must be a very empowering feeling to have experienced that and then know what a difference that makes. It's just capturing that lightning in a bottle again, isn't it?
And over my career, I always would go back to that and go, okay, what mood am I in? Because it's all about the mood I was in, you know. So that mood that day was very different to any other day
yeah.
that I had been in. So
to put the helmet on. I mean, you know, you before you would just be sitting there, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and you know, I couldn't even see the lot. Well, we didn't have lights. It was the yeah. flag. I couldn't even see the flag because I was around the hairpin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was so angry. I got in the car and I'm just I can feel the blood boiling still while I was in the car, which I'd never felt before. And I'm telling my mechanic, I said, you get down there and you tell those guys in front, I'm coming through, so get out of my way, you know. So he'd walk down there, he'd start talking to a few, come back, and I said, what they say? He said, F off. So it's like, blood boils again, you know what I mean? And then when we got going, I mean, I drove at a level I didn't even know existed within me, you know what I mean? So it taught me a lot about the mindset after that, which...
What did your dad say to you afterwards?
Well, it was satisfying to have won that race. And what was nice, I guess, in many ways, that, you know, Dad could see what the rate in what I was catching the leaders.
Yeah.
He grabbed Ken Tyrrell. He grabbed Jackie Stewart. He said, oi, come and have a look at this. They were on the pit wall with a mate of mine because he was telling me all of this. And I'm just, you know, catching them 2-3 seconds a lap, you know, just... wherever there was a bit of space, I was there, you know, diving down the inside, round the outside, up over the curb, up over the top of them. It didn't matter. I was going to win that race regardless. And I kind of feel like, you know, someone like Senna could recreate that nearly every time he got in the car. If that's what he felt every time he got in the car, you can see why he was so good. You know, I couldn't replicate that. I had to have triggers in a way. You know, my personality was different to other people. So I knew to get the best out of me, I had to find something that just gave me that extra push, that extra motivation. Normally it needed to piss me off a bit. and then I could take it to another level.
We are quickly running out of time.
Are we?
But we've had a question... or maybe just a statement from Martin McMillan about how great it was to see you at Bathurst this year.
Yeah.
In the GT86 and the livery as well.
Yep.
How's that?
Brilliant. Yeah, it was nice to go back. I mean, Mike Breen from Toyota there is someone I've known for years. In fact, when I did Ford Lasers in 1985, he was involved in that championship. So we go back a long way. And he's been with Toyota a long time, and he was putting this series together. And I knew about it because he said, look, we'd like you to come and do a race or two if we can arrange it, you know. So I knew an invitation would come at the right time, and we tried a couple of times. We couldn't quite do it. And then, of course, this year he said, look, how would you like to come and do Bathurst? And I looked at my schedule and went, yep. So they are
delete.
Yeah, exactly. They asked me about, you know, what livery do you want? Well, that's a good question. So, you know, with everything we're kind of working on in the background, I thought, well, here's an opportunity to see what a kind of retro livery looks like on a modern car. Sean Bull came up with the design, and we said, yep, let's run with that. And the response was amazing. I mean, everybody walked past there and went, I like that. So that was really cool. And of course, in throughout the weekend, you know, I mean, I turn up, this is the car, we go straight into practice, no power, so it's a very very different driving style.
First up the mountain, didn't
it? Yeah, exactly. You nearly had to go down again. But I tell you what, if you lost the momentum, you were toast, you know. And then the second session, I had a problem, so I didn't get to run. I was straight into qualifying. I qualified like 25th. I'm thinking, this is embarrassing, you know. I've got to get my act together. But I kind of brought the experience in over 30 years to sort of know where to place it at the right time to avoid the carnage in front of me. And, you know, the last race, I end up finishing 7th, I think. So it was quite satisfying in many ways, but it's just nice to go back and drive that amazing racetrack and be amongst these young guys who reminded me of myself back in 85, you know, of them on a path of trying to make a career out of motorsport.
Someone found an amazing stat on Facebook that three people have won the Bathurst 1000 and Le Mans. So it's you and your brother.
Yeah.
And the third is impossible. No one in the office could get it.
Jackie Hicks.
It is, yeah. That's an amazing stat. That must just blew my mind.
I know.
He did in the same year as well.
did you do in the same
77,
year?
77, yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, what a phenomenal driver he was, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it's pretty cool to think we're the only ones to do that. I think I'm the only one to have won Bathurst and Spa 24 hour. So
that's another good,
yeah, it's
good
another stat. Interesting stat, which I keep in my back pocket.
You know. Is there a category of racing you wished you'd done that you have? I mean, you've ticked most of the boxes, but is there a particular race or a particular category?
Yeah, there is. I think Indy 500.
I was wondering if it might be that.
I tried a couple of times to go over there and find an opportunity, but I think at the time my heart really wasn't in it because I was so much into the European thing that the move over to America, if an good opportunity said, yeah, look, you know, let's seriously have a chat about this, it probably would have helped. But, you know, it was like, well, how much money can you bring? And, you know, that sort of thing. I said, well, I don't bring money, I get paid, you know, and that's what I'm used to. But there really wasn't that kind of opportunity at that particular moment. I think if I'd have gone after I'd left F1 in 90 and gone over there, I thought, okay, fine, it didn't work in Formula One, I'll go and do IndyCars. I think I could have had a pretty good career in IndyCars. But
the dangerous times though then, weren't they?
IndyCars, they were, actually. But you know, that's part of the reason I went racing, because of the danger, you know, pushing yourself against that that potential death trap, you know. But that's what I did. That's why I liked it, you know. And, you know, I saw Jeff race there and the Indy 500. Okay, I think it's, you know, certainly one of the best racing events in the world. And to win that would have been pretty amazing, you know. My dad went there, you know, first time in 61 with a rear engine car, which no one could get their head round. And, you know, did really well. He probably could have, you know, finish in the top three if he hadn't had the wrong tyres. I think at the time the Dunlop would just wear out and they had a cross thread and so lost a lot of time. I think he finished ninth. You know, Jeff's race there, Matthew's race there. So three generations have been there. But in terms of an overall victory, it's one that's missing from the family. Yeah. We've done the F1 thing. Yeah. We've done the Le Mans thing. It'd be nice to do the Indy thing.
One final question, I think, was from James Gent, and he wants your view on the halo. Given what you just said, you weren't racing for the danger, and I guess you're anti-halo then.
Yeah, I'm old school still, you know. Like I said, I mean, part of the reason for going racing, get up and going racing, is that you know that you're pushing yourself against the limits, and there's danger. And that thrill of the fact that there's danger there excited me. Might seem weird to some people, but that's how I felt.
No, I think we've been conditioned to think that now, haven't we? Everyone's so risk-averse that it's almost taboo subject if you say you're comfortable with something being dangerous.
But. Yeah, I think I went through a really great period of racing because it wasn't like my dad's era, where there was a lot of accidents and deaths.
Is that why you think he didn't want you to, because it was such a brutal era that he raced?
He lost a lot of friends. And so when he retired at 44, I think he felt he could have gone on for another couple of years.
Seems bizarre now to be in Formula One, 44.
Yeah, I mean, he nearly won the championship. I mean, he was a championship contender in 1944. Sorry, 1944, that's all. 1970. And he was 44. Now, when I look at my career, my peak was 43, 44 in terms of my ability to
reach a level. I guess that's what I was alluding to with the, you know, the pressure for F1 to take younger and younger drivers. Do you think it's, you had a craft to learn, and certainly with your dad's era of car, you couldn't just drop someone in who'd not done that much racing and expect them to master a machine that requires that's that analog and do you think the sport's losing something? Because, and then no disrespect to Max and the guys that are, you know, super young now, because they're obviously incredibly talented, but the cars they're in are so different, aren't they, and the requirements from the driver are so different. Do you think some of that man machine kind of,
I think,
the interface is lost now,
the gladiator type scenario. You know, Bernie was very good at making sure that F1 drivers in the sort of 80s and 90s were gladiators. You know, that they were kind of untouchable and so forth. The danger element fueled that. And me, for a driver, that's what I quite – that's what I've always enjoyed. You know, I've never been one for walking around the track and going to the officials, "Oh, that looks dangerous," or "That looks dangerous." It is what it is. Let's just get on with it. You know, I don't want to hit it, so I won't, you know.
Yeah.
So when I see things how it's developed, you know, it's a culture of thinking now where the FIA in particular are very safety conscious. They're involved in a lot of safety programs. They can't be seen to be promoting danger, you know what I mean? So there's a conflict there between what racing used to be like and what it is now. And I think, certainly from my point of view, not that I want to see anyone get hurt, but I think we've kind of gone a little bit too far where, you know, if you went off in my day, you there was a consequence. Now,
the consequences are arguing with the stewards and
the first. Yeah, all it is you're arguing with the stewards whether you've crossed the white line, and of course you can and come back on.
Yeah.
But back then, the limit was the limit, and you respected that. And so in my era, there wasn't that many deaths, but there was still dangerous enough to make you realize that actually you had to stay on a certain line. If you went over that, you dropped a wheel on the grass, there's a wall right next to you, you know. So the respect level of that limit was much higher, I think, than what it is today. And racing has changed a lot. You know, you can't keep it the same all the time. It's always evolving and changing. Whether we need to, I don't know how we get away from it, because the whole world is going through this massive shift of you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't, you know, danger, danger, danger. Yeah. But, you know, it's sort of sterilizing things. It's not just racing, it's everywhere. And you know, I like a bit of risk.
So now I really want to talk about your Macau win, but I think...
Macau win, yeah.
But I think we're out of time, so save that for the next one in 3 years' time, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, so, well, the Macau weekend hasn't changed, so we can still talk about it.
That's true. And you've still beaten Schumacher at Macau, so... But we'll leave that for next time.
That's the pub talk.
Yeah. So thank you for the hour.
Thanks, guys.
Hour.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.
We'll be watching Project Brabham.
Yep.
Sounds like something's happening, so there's reason to keep paying attention. And thank you, Dickie. Thank you, Alan.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
And we have probably a few more podcasts between now and the end of the year. So do subscribe and tell your friends. We'll speak to you next time.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. The way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.